The first is that everything starts with the self. And it's really, really important for you to feel like you are in a good spot physically, mentally, socially, from a financial health standpoint. Like, we wouldn't want anyone to feel like they are barely hanging on and now they're going to read a book about networking and how they need to network, right? Like, that's not what we do. We actually start the book with chapter one on self-care, because we think at the most fundamental level, you should make sure that you are in a good spot to sort of think about your professional ambitions.
Are you a health professional wanting to explore all the options life has to offer? Then you've come to the right place. The Balanced Medics Handover podcast is all about living outside the box of what we've been told. I'm Isabella, your host, a junior doctor from Australia and trained coach. I'll be interviewing health professionals from all walks of life, artists, authors, non-clinical specialists, and more. These stories show that our choices are endless. Let's take the journey together. This is The Handover. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Handover podcast. I'm really excited to have two guests from the East Coast this episode. We have Dr. Risa E. Lewis and Dr. Adara Landry calling in to discuss their paths in medicine and their upcoming book. Risa and Adara are both emergency medicine physicians, ultrasound trained clinicians, medical educators, speakers. Risa is also a podcaster, host of the Visible Voices podcast, and they're both writers. So it's really great to have you on to talk about the soon-to-be-published book, Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impacts. It's a business self-help book all about reaching big goals in small, actionable steps. So without further ado, let's hand over to Risa and Adara. Hey, how are you?
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting us.
Yes, thank you so much.
It's great to have you both here. It's really fun to have two guests on as well, because I'm used to the one-on-one, so it's fun to have a group of us. So can you both share your own journeys in medicine, and you know, how did you get to this point in time where you are now?
I guess I will focus that answer on my journey to being a writer. I would say for the majority of my early adult life, I avoided writing. It just was not something that was important to me. And I think I had probably devalued it because I thought it was one of those innate skills that either you're born with or you're not. And so I wasn't a writer. And so I just sort of overlooked it. It wasn't until a few years ago that it started to become something of more interest for me. After George Floyd was murdered, I, with two colleagues, wrote an article for USA Today sort of related to our perspective on his murder. And it did insanely well. And it was funny because we had compared that to the few times we had written academic pieces, and we spent way more time on it and wondered if anyone had read it. And so that was the first time I sort of thought about this idea of publishing outside of the lay press as being a bigger skill that I would want to work on. Recently, I started to work together around that time, and we had sort of a similar response, which was that people really loved seeing and reading about the doctor's perspective, but in like a lay press, larger, non-medical audience. And sort of just seeing how the themes of the workplace that we see, you know, within the hospital are actually quite universal and are applicable to broader industries. And I think after working on a few articles, you know, I thought this is really amazing. And also, when you write articles, you don't get paid for those. And so I'm always thinking about, like, how do you like, you know, commoditize the work that you're doing? How do you find ways to make it bigger, more impactful? And one of those was making that sort of journey as writers of articles to writers of books. And a book is a really nice, just finite project because there's like an endpoint to it. And I started to think about this idea, I think, after my third child. I have three kids. So when I was on maternity leave, I was like, this is as crazy as it sounds, I was like, this is a perfect time to start writing this book because I didn't have shifts. I didn't have meetings. Yes, I had the child, but they sleep a lot. They do. And so I was used to it by then. And I'm still a productive, you know, energetic person. So I was like, I want to do something with this time when my kid is sleeping. So that's when I started to, you know, look into the idea of writing a book. And I, Risa was the first person I thought of because we had such a positive experience writing articles together and just made natural sense to collaborate with her.
Oh, I love that. And I love that that's how you found each other to write the book as well. It was a really organic move towards the book.
Yeah. To your point, we had a lot of overlapping worlds, being in the geographically northeast part of the United States, emergency medicine, education, ultrasound, you hit them all. And I'll say that my path to being a physician writer started when I was young. I am one of those people that always thought, I want to be a doctor. Now, nobody in my family is a doctor. And I've shared, my parents had very traditional expectations for their children. Boys do this, girls do that. And in their mind, girls didn't necessarily become doctors. And, you know, I always had it in me. And I always sort of thought, if I do well in my coursework, then I'm going to go for this. And I strongly identified as a math science person, not as a writing English history person. So sure, I wrote the requisite essays to get into college, medical school, residency, but that was about it. And I didn't really think that I was able to write. I, like a Derrisher, I thought it was like you had it or you didn't. You were a good writer or you weren't. And I was trying to become promoted and progress in the academic world. And I had one aha moment where a senior faculty member essentially was like, well, you know, you want to get promoted, you want to move up the academic chain, but you haven't published anything. And it was true in terms of, you know, peer-reviewed publications in the medical literature, I really hadn't. So it was sort of one of these moments. It was much more dramatic than I'm describing it here, but I really had a, okay, game on. I'm going to figure this thing out called writing. I'd always been a reader and I love books. And I started reading about writing. And I started trying to understand my friends that seemed to get published in the medical journals every week. They had something, another case report, another education innovation. I'm like, how do they do it? I started having a lot of one-on-one conversations. And then another faculty advisor said, you know, Risa, you don't review at all for medical journals. Why is that? And I was like, oh, I thought they needed to somehow ask me. He's like, no, you ask them. And there's a whole theme that Adair and I actually talk about in our book about asking. So I asked a bunch of journals, sent a short email. Hello, I'd like to be a peer reviewer for a journal. Next thing you knew, I was like a peer reviewer for about five journals. It's like, oh. But that allowed me to edit and learn about editing articles that were submitted. And I also was able to see what people write, how people write, what is publishable. And it really gave me this inside view as to how to start organizing my writing. Now, that was all medical writing. The writing for a broader audience came around 2017, 2018, 2019. I started getting involved in some emergency medicine and healthcare advocacy groups where the other people I met were writing op-eds in mainstream newspapers or in some of the mainstream journals. And I thought, oh, you can do that? Like, and of course you can do it, but it never struck me that I could do it. And I was also at the same time reading those journals like Harvard Business Review, like Fast Company, and I loved the articles. They talked a lot about how to be better at work, how to communicate, how to be a leader. And this is all stuff I would read about anyway. So it was a combination of cracking the how to be a writer and how to write and how to get better at it, plus realizing that I could do it. And also, Adair and I speak a lot about, as physician authors, like it's actually important that we wrote this book. You know, a lot of business self-help books are C-suite people, white men. And there's this understanding or there's this perception or there's this given that like, oh, they're writing a book for everybody. But we all know we've read books and we're like, this book doesn't really talk to me. And so just like they are writing a book that's assumed to be for everybody, we too wrote a book that's for everybody. And a lot of people think, oh, it's for doctors, right? And we're like, no. Oh, it's for women, right? And we're like, no. And we kind of specifically in our introduction state that, you know, we really wanted to write a book that's accessible for everybody, and we try to make no assumptions about where people are coming from and where they may have acquired privilege, network, knowledge, resources, and we really just try to give it to everybody to help everybody be better at work.
It's giving me goosebumps as you say it. Just, it's a book for everyone, and it's not just, you know, for women. It's not just for this person, for people in medicine. It's for everyone, written by women, yes, but it's for everyone. And I love the representation as well, because even books by doctors and about, you know, medicine, it's very much written by men, like mainly. So it's great that there are, that you guys are writing this book, and I'm excited to read it. Now, I also wanted to ask you both, because you're both emergency physicians, ED, we call it over here. What drew you to this side of medicine?
Well, I can start actually. It's a really funny story because we're talking about writing. I, like Risa, I knew at a young age that I would be a doctor. There was a combination of me wanting to do it as well as my parents conditioning me to do it. Just by my mom put me in piano, and she was like, "You have surgeon's fingers." She would always say that. She would always tell me, "I have fingers like a surgeon." I don't know what that means, but and so, you know, it just sort of became part of the culture of the household, was that I was going to be a doctor from like a very young age. But I would say emergency medicine for me was when I was taking an English course. In college, I was walking to the classroom, and actually one of my classmates was on the floor, unresponsive. And there was a group of people around, but no one was doing anything. And I don't consider myself, especially at that point in time, like a leader who would just jump in and do things. But I was like, "Oh, call 911. And I looked at him, and I saw that he had one of those medical bracelets on. And so I looked at it, and I saw that it said diabetes. It was like a first year in college. So I didn't know. I knew what diabetes was, but I didn't know if his sugar was too high or too low, if I should give him something. Like, you know, I didn't know anything beyond that. And I just stood there, and I actually just held his hand, and I just told him, like, it's going to be okay. He ended up, you know, regaining consciousness, and actually the next, so he went to the ambulance, and the next day I showed up to class, and there's like a huge bouquet of flowers, and he just wrote like, "Thank you so much for holding my hand and being there for me," which I thought was really sweet. And then a few months later, I was actually in the kitchen of my own house, and I was cooking some food, and I was actually deep frying something, and the hot oil just spilled off of the stove, and like, I burned me here and all over my chest. And they were first, second, and a little bit of third degree burns, but the third degree part was very small. But it was so painful, so painful. And I just remember like lying on the floor, and I was alone, and I didn't have a cell phone at the time, because it was before I even had a cell phone, and just like being unable to move for hours, and just thinking like, "Oh my God, I'm all alone and I'm in pain." And I think it was the combination of, you know, sort of having the worst day of your life and being in so much pain and not having someone there to support you. And then thinking about what a gift it was to be there for my classmate, Barry, who really was grateful for just someone being there to support them. That really drew me to this idea of like acuity, high acuity medicine, and being there when someone was like at their worst. And I think when I ultimately did my rotations, I like just kept thinking about to those two moments. And I just felt like it really spoke to me that I could just be there to support people. I mean, I do a lot more than that, but I think the most human aspect of our job is actually the conversation, the physical touch.
For me, I thought I was going to be a surgeon, although I was not one of those people that started medical school thinking, knowing what specialty I was going to pursue. In fact, I was a little concerned that nothing was striking me. I was doing all my rotations, all my clinicals. And I'm like, "That's okay. That's okay. That's okay." But nothing spoke to me. Surgery and surgical subspecialties spoke to me the most. But even then, I knew I didn't love it. I took a year off in med school and did research for the year. And when I was returning from that year, I thought, "Gosh, I need to get back into the clinical mindset. Let me do an emergency medicine rotation." And I did it. And I was in med school in Philadelphia. And where I was in med school, there was a rotation, but it was full, so I couldn't get into it. But I thought that's okay because there's one place, one program that is known to be a really, really good emergency medicine program. That's where I want to do my medical student rotation. And I was blown away. I thought, where have I been? This is it. And it was sort of, I looked at the colleagues and they just were kind and competent and knew how to take care of all different presentations of patients who came to the department. I thought this is a very practical, this is a very doable. I liked that the people were down to earth. It was okay to admit that you liked doing things outside the hospital. And I liked that you worked shifts. So you knew where you were on, you knew when you were off. And I did one more confirmatory rotation in emergency medicine. I was like, yeah, this is it. These are my people. This is it. I also did the litmus of if you read a journal of that specialty, do you like the articles in that journal? And I was going to go into ENT. And I liked maybe a third, maybe a half of the articles that would be in an ENT journal. But when I read the EM, emergency medicine journal, I liked virtually every article. And there's so much of the social responsibility and the taking care of everybody that resonates with who I am and what I think is important, that it just was the right specialty for me. And then sidebar, growing up, I loved horror movies and I always liked blood and guts. So none of that ever bothered me. In fact, I kind of liked it.
Yeah. There's a bit of surgeon, you know, in both your stories, surgical fingers being more drawn to surgery, and then writing, you know, the journals that you read. So it's interesting that what helped you choose as well was literature and words. Now you're both writers. You both told us already like how you got into writing. You have a book, Micro Skills, coming out the 16th of April. Is that mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
Correct.
What sparked this book? What was the inspiration?
I'll give my one liner. Adair and I say, this is the book we wish we had been given when we were starting our professional journey. There's much more to it, but I'll mic to Adair.
You know, I am an advisor for the medical school here in Boston, and I've also been an assistant residency director as well as an interim fellowship director. And all of these positions, you know, tasked me to help support the careers of early career professionals. And to me, this book is the ultimate example of how you can take one thing that you're doing on a regular basis and those skills that you're employing in one space can be used elsewhere. And so to me, the most logical thing was to write a book that really reflected the day-to-day work I was doing. And it also really reflects my own journey. And I think Risa's journey very closely as well, because we infuse a lot of our personal stories of how we have done something incorrectly in the past, or we could have done something better, or we witnessed the successes or mistakes of others, but it's all from our own lens. It's all the advice that we truly give people on a day-to-day basis when we're, you know, meeting with our peers, meeting with our students. It really feels like a natural extension of our personal selves, our professional selves, but it's in a written form. And we really hope it feels like a gift to the reader because we spent so much time working on this book. I mean, it took about 3 years from the time we started it to the time it's launched. And that's a lot of revisions, a lot of conversations, a lot of Google Docs, a lot of meetings and podcasts, just with the hope that, you know, we are giving someone the book that we wish we had.
I'll add that we both had some similar, some differing, it's definitely overlapping stories, experiences where we were with colleagues, classmates, peers that somehow knew how to get things done. They were already on research projects. They were back to writing. In my residency class, all my residency classmates seemed to have writing projects and I didn't. And I thought somehow these attendings, these faculty knew that I wasn't a good writer. It was like, no, it was, and this goes back to the sort of reaching out and showing, taking initiative and asking. But we, for whatever reason, I played sports growing up, and I like joking about the playbook. It seemed like other people, when they signed up for medicine, got a copy of the playbook. And I always felt like I didn't get this copy of the playbook. Part of it was no one in my family's in medicine. And the people that had family members in medicine definitely had an inside scoop or knowledge. So it was partially that. But Adair and I have both been successful. We're ambitious. We've gotten there. And also, it could have been easier. It could have been more efficient. Gosh, if we knew some of these things. So what we put in writing are some of the ways to navigate the workplace that, gosh, it could have been more efficient and quicker and easier if there had been a book to read all this content.
Yeah. Oh, that's so important. And it's true. There's like this hidden curriculum, right? The hidden knowledge of any workplace, medicine included, and you do see people doing things and you're like, oh, was I supposed to do that? Is that what you're supposed to do? So that's really helpful. Can you share, is there any themes that you can share? Or I know you don't want to give everything away before we publish it.
Oh, we're ready. So
the book is ready. Great.
Yeah. I mean, meaning the book is 10 chapters and we had a lot of beta readers give us feedback on what was most important to make sure we cover. And each chapter is made up of about 7 to 11 micro skills within the chapter. And I was just going to read them to you. Micro skills for self-care. And we intentionally started that as our chapter one, because we think many industries don't tell people how to take care of themselves. And it's not just physical health, it's financial health, it's developing relationships with people you trust who will help you navigate the professional journey, minding your calendar, taking care of yourself in terms of protecting yourself regarding meetings. Then there's micro skills to manage a task list, micro skills for polished communication, to build and maintain your reputation, for becoming a subject matter expert, to learn your workplace culture, to be a team player, to grow your network, for navigating conflict, and finally, micro skills to actively find new opportunities. We spoke with one host who said, why didn't you just title this book, How to Be a Kind Person? Because these are all, again, but this sort of just echoes this concept of these skills and what we talk about are really should resonate with everybody, no matter their industry.
Mm-hmm. We also in the book have two unique themes that we weave through. I'll share one. The first is that everything starts with the self. And it's really, really important for you to feel like you are in a good spot physically, mentally, socially, from a financial health standpoint. Like we wouldn't want anyone to feel like they are barely hanging on and now they're going to read a book about networking and how they need to network, right? Like that's not what we do. We actually start the book with chapter one on self-care because we think at the most fundamental level, you should make sure that you are in a good spot to sort of think about your professional ambitions. So that's the most fundamental level. Next is the team, the people who you are surrounded by. And that can be within your actual job, within your industry. That could be your family, your friends, just the people around you who are going to support you, who you're going to be collaborating with, who are going to inspire you, who you might go to when there's hardship. And then the next level is going to be the actual work, meaning the projects, the due dates, the timelines, the presentations, the spreadsheets, all of that stuff. But as you see, we put the human aspect first. And I think that's honestly why this book is great coming from two physicians. We just see on a regular basis the toll that stress can play on the body, on the mind, on our emotional state. And so we really want to emphasize that we want you to feel well. We don't want to create a culture of self-sacrifice as a way to get to success. So that was the first thing, the self, the work, the team. I'll let Risa talk about the three truths.
Yeah. In our introduction, we start the reader with three truths. Number one, time can only be spent. We consider time like a currency, and you can't put it into a savings account. And if you don't spend it on one thing, then you're going to spend it on another. So we sort of advise the reader, you know, be intentional and thoughtful about how you spend your time and with whom you spend your time. The next is The World Is Not Equal. And that's sort of a call out to many of the books, the comparative titles that we reviewed in writing our book, made so many assumptions, and assumptions of privilege, assumptions of a network, assumptions of resources. And we tried to write from a place of making no assumptions and not assuming that people had access, which is why a lot of books would tell people to go out and do something. And what makes our writing in our book different is we try to break it down into steps to teach the reader how. We call them critical actions. And then finally, learning is limitless if accessible. And it talks to that accessibility, the privilege that, you know, I have traveled many, many places teaching ultrasound all over the world. At the end of the day, everybody wants food, shelter, clothing, and education. And we sort of, it's a call to action for the reader to have a growth mindset and to be open to learning, and also that no one is coming to save them. They themselves have to be most interested in their own professional journey. So let's go.
Yeah. All three truths. I am really looking forward to reading. It seems really clear, like, you know, the truths, every chapter, very well ordered and digestible and practical.
We tried to actually, I think we initially had it more of a narrative format in the way beginning, like it was just going to be, you know, like one sort of long book, like you've read many business books like that, where it's just big chunks of text and heavy data. That just really isn't how we like to write. And the good news was that we had those articles as a proof of concept before we even got into the book. And our writing is, you know, the term is prescriptive, which is really funny because we are doctors, but the term is independent of us being doctors. But prescriptive business self-help, which is like, we tell you what to do, right? Take two tabs of this at this time, right? But instead, it's the business way of that, which is like, call your network when you're in this situation. And I think that probably comes naturally to us because we are used to telling people to do very concrete, actionable things to improve themselves in the clinical setting. Now we're just doing it in a business self-help space. I think the interesting thing is that people were really surprised to hear that doctors could write about the workplace. And it's like, what environment do they think we work in? Like, we have colleagues, we have peers, we have supervisors, we have, you know, our customers, our patients, but we're still in the customer service space where we need to satisfy people. We need to like give them what they need or what they're requesting. I mean, to a certain extent, we do that, obviously. But, you know, there's like this very similar theme of interacting with people, with, you know, managing your supervisor's expectations, with navigating conflict. I mean, if you want workplace conflict, come to the emergency room.
Yeah.
I love my job, but there's conflict, right? And so, and, you know, it's a really interesting way of, I think, talking about the same themes that would be in a book by a McKinsey consultant, except I think we use very interesting stories that are like our personal experiences, not made up characters like Sarah and John, but actually these are things that we have seen, that we have observed. And I think it's actually people are really engaged with the narratives that we put into the story because they're set, a lot of them are set in the emergency room. But again, we're talking about general themes.
Yeah. And I was going to also say that in medicine, teamwork, right? There's such a dynamic team mm-hmm. of doctors and nurses yes. and allied health. And then you're working with the patient. It's very complicated. Now, can you share how your work in the ED has influenced this book and your writing? So you shared that you use stories, but what else has influenced it?
We talk in the beginning about what is a micro skill and why that framework. And we define a micro skill as a small concrete building block or a fundamental step when you are tasked with a big project or a big goal, or there's a character trait, we think everything can be broken down into small steps. And by learning these small steps, they are additive and they help you get to these bigger places. And one example that we provided is when you're learning how to suture a laceration. There are so many steps in terms of cleansing, anesthetizing, before all that, actually making sure you have the right patient, confirming their date of birth, you know, the setup, the preparation, the suturing, all the pieces, the steps, the small steps that add up to ultimately taking care of a patient with a wound. Similarly, I make the reference or the analogy to tying a shoe. And, you know, I distinctly remember as a child struggling, learning all the steps to tying a shoe, from, you know, pulling out the tongue, slipping in your foot, putting your heel down, bringing the tongue back, tightening the laces, all the steps. And so by breaking things down into small steps, we really want the reader to adopt this mindset that things seem so much more doable. And you can bring some of the steps that you've learned for other tasks, projects, skills, and use them for the next big thing.
I think the other thing that just working in the emergency room has provided this insight, and I mentioned this very briefly, but this insight of how important it is to take care of yourself. And I know I've mentioned it a bunch, but it's so important because we've read a lot of books that are truly like grind it out, put your head down, stop complaining. I mean, not necessarily as explicit as that, but that is the message, right? Like, the absence of compassion to me implies self-sacrifice when you're reading a book that's talking about how you need to show up, put in FaceTime, and, you know, over deliver. Like, to me, if you're not really mentioning the language of take a break, you know, eat healthy foods, sleep, then that sort of implies it's not valuable to you. And so I think as a writer, we really wanted to infuse that throughout the book, because we see patients all the time who come in. You know, I just took care of a patient a few days ago who had, I mean, this is like a generic patient. They come in all the time with the same story. They were you know, doing a lot of work, and they you know, hurt their back, they injured their back, and they need to get back to work because that's how they make their money. But they're going to continue to hurt their back if they don't stop. And so we talk a lot about financial health and putting yourself in a position where, like, you're not stuck having to do a job that causes you harm. Now, of course, there's a lot of privilege just in that entire concept. Like, not everyone has the choice, but it's important to think about if you do. And if you do have the choice, do you want to continue to cause harm to your well-being, to your relationships, to your physical body, all of that?
Yeah, and there's so much to what you just said. You know, the stress in the workplace, you see it in the patients, but I'm imagining you also see it in colleagues. You know, burnout is at an all-time high at the moment in healthcare workers, not just physicians. And then the importance of compassion and human first. And you wrote in what you sent me that being successful should not require self-sacrifice. And you've said it already. And it's so important that that's in the book, because you're right. A lot of these business books do not mention the human feeling, do not mention that people eat and sleep and need human connection.
That's exactly right. And we know healthcare is not the only industry. And in fact, going back to our beta readers, so many resonated with what we wrote because they're not taught it in law or education or banking or consulting. So we know it's not modeled, it's not taught, it's not prioritized. And so, again, this is why we thought it was really important to start the book with that as our chapter one.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And now we know who this book is for. It's for everyone. I wanted to ask you both, what is your hope with this book?
On a personal level, I just think getting to this point is a huge accomplishment. So I just hope to continue to recognize that, because, you know, just sort of knowing other people who have published, there's a wide range of responses you can get once the book is out. But I hope to just continue to center myself on writing a book is very hard. And we did something that is really challenging for many people to do. So that part I hope to keep in the forefront of my mind. I hope also, I mean, for Risa and I, we both want to continue to write. So I think that's, like I said, on a personal level, I hope that's still there. And then I hope for everyone else that they really feel like they got better at work because of this book, that there was something, even if it's one small thing, a sentence that made them think, oh my gosh, I need to stop doing this because it's hurting myself and I don't have to do this. That's our goal, is that people pick up the book, they turn to the page that they want to read, and they feel inspired, changed, better.
I also believe the content is evergreen. So, you know, there's a whole industry around book launches, and Adair and I have done a lot of reading and gotten a lot of input from a lot of people. And, you know, ultimately we navigated the path that felt right to the both of us. So in the near term, I'm trying to really continue enjoying this launch period. It's been really fun. I do think we have this beautiful product, which is the book. And it's been amazing how much support and warm reception the book has gotten, we have gotten. It's just great. I'm really trying to be very present and feel that. You know, I think, as I mentioned, evergreen in the content, my hope is that the book resonates, not in a month, not in 6 months, but really for years to come. We think this is a book that will help the ready for college, the ready for work, the early career professionals. And gosh, you know, things change, times change, you know, what's trendy changes, but we think there's enough in here that will withstand the test of time. And so I hope the book is something that's referred to for years and people see it as, you know, a good foundational text for the workplace.
Wow, I'm looking forward to reading it and sharing it with the listeners today that are tuning in. And also, just want to acknowledge that, wow, a lot of work, 3 years. So congrats to get it done. I know a lot of people have dreams to write a book in their life, but actually doing it and publishing it is a huge achievement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I want both of you to go back in time to your intern self. If you could say one thing to them, what would you say?
It's okay to quit things. When I was a resident, I was taught what I think now is a very toxic phrase, say yes to everything. And so, you know, when you are a motivated person, people see that and they continue to offer you work. And so that motivation can actually be quite harmful to the individual. And even though it's like a positive trait. And so I, probably like Risa, very motivated in residency. And so a lot of opportunities came my way and I said yes to everything because that's what I assumed to be the case, as like the most strategic, you know, decision. And then I found myself constantly fighting the calendar, you know, and having to switch my shifts so that I can make meetings and sleeping less and stressing out over all sorts of, you know, projects on my plate. And so I know I would tell myself that it's okay to say, you know, I know I committed to this, but in truth, I no longer have the time or I'm no longer interested. And I think it's best for me to step down. I never did that until I would say a few years ago, I started just to step down from things. But I just sort of assumed that once you commit, you have to take something to the finish line. And that logic plus the practice of saying yes to everything, that combination is a recipe for disaster, especially in a motivated person.
I would tell my intern self, trust your gut. Trust your gut. You're not imagining it. you're not the only one seeing this. You're not the only one experiencing this. Trust your gut.
Thank you for sharing. I feel like it's so wise always when you go back to your intern self, the advice that you have. The permission to say no to things is huge. And on your point, Adara, I think that sometimes, even though it's a positive trait and what's like kind of your superpower, can sometimes, like they say, also be a detriment if it goes too far, right? When it's not useful. So it's so true. Risa, trust your gut. I love that, because sometimes you can be told maybe what you're seeing is not what's happening, and you're like, I'm pretty sure it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's very sure true.
Now, what would you say to the doctors listening out there considering writing and venturing out into maybe another passion outside of medicine as well, if it's not writing?
We actually have in the book, because we think this is such an important thing, a chapter on finding your next opportunity. And one of the micro skills in that chapter is learning how to convert or transfer your skills from one arena to another place. You know, I think writing for us, even though it was a skill that we didn't practice so much early in our careers, it started to come naturally because we do a lot of writing on a regular basis with charting and sending emails. And so I think we're just sort of taking the mechanics of one skill set and moving it to a different space. But a lot of people assume they don't have skills that are transferable to different industries, different positions, different fields altogether. And so I think that part is really important, is you can take whatever it is that's bothering you, that's inspiring you, that you want to change, that you want to improve, that you want to spotlight, and write about it. Writing to me is like, just individually, I feel like it's a very therapeutic practice. Like, I personally feel better when I have spent time writing about something that's bothering me. But I also hope that for other people, it's therapeutic to read what I wrote, because my goal is to make their day, their lives, their careers better by publishing pieces. Everything that Reese and I have definitely written together has always been under the lens of, this is going to make the workplace healthier, more compassionate, more efficient.
I'm a big believer in the more you develop yourself and do the things that bring you joy, the better you are to anything you do. So that's vague. Seth Godin is an author that I've read, and he has this phrase, just make art and put it out into the world. And in my case, I think one example would be podcasting and the podcast conversations. I really enjoy them, and they're not all perfect. And, you know, it's been a work in progress, all the audio, all the video, all the pieces, but he says, and I read it again in one of his books, just make art and put it out into the world. And so I think the more we continue to do things in addition to whatever our main occupation is, the better we are in ourselves, the more authentically we're expressing ourselves. And that comes with time, that comes with age, comes with comfort, that comes with comfort in one's own skin and maturity. So I don't know what, there's another phrase I'm trying to think, like, no one else can be you. You know, you're the only you there is in the world. And so so many of the training years, and teen to 20s to 30s, is, you know, we're training a lot of years, a lot of pressures, a lot of expectations, and people don't have time to be with themselves and to necessarily get to know themselves. And the system requires, premature maturity, premature responsibility, that if the people don't actually do the work with themselves, going back to that chapter one of micro skills for self-care, then by the time they are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, they're never quite feeling free or joyful or content or like they've expressed themselves. So I see writing, I see podcasting. These are examples of expression and self-expression. And I would encourage anybody to find ways that they want to express themselves and go for it.
Hmm. Yeah, I love that. So it's so important, right, to be able to authentically be you, authentically express yourself. And I want to say as well, Risa, you have a really great podcasting voice. I was listening to your podcast like, wow.
She really does.
Sounds amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that's kudos to you on that. What is balance to you? I ask this of everyone that comes on.
Well, I don't really subscribe to the idea of work-life balance because I don't think it's possible. I think it's a myth. I think it's more of an awareness of your time and your energy levels that I'm striving to just try to regulate better. And so for me, I like to probably not use the word balance and more like control. I'm not a control freak, but if you listen to a lot of podcasts, you'll hear me use that word control a lot, because I think a lot of burnout is driven by a sense of lack of control. Like you just can't control nothing is under your control, and you have to do all this work and there's no recognition. I mean, so for me, I think what I try to do is feel like I have a sense of control with my schedule, with the projects I'm working on, with, you know, when I rest, how I rest. That is very important to me. But I think this idea of like balancing kids and work, that it's so vague, because it really depends on the day, you know, and if they're home, if they're not home, if I have a shift. So I don't really go for that. I just feel like I'm trying to get to the point in life where I feel like I have control over who I am and what I work on.
Yeah, that self-agency and what you do with your time and who. Yeah, you
maybe
are.
Agency is a softer word than control. But it's the same idea, yeah. Right? That like I've put in a lot of time into my career. And I think for a lot of my colleagues, we feel kind of the same way, that the hardest part is when you're becoming more and more senior, but you don't actually feel like you have increased responsibility. I mean, you have increased sense of control or that agency as far as who you are as a professional.
I also don't subscribe to the concept of work-life balance or, you know, personal professional balance. I think it is something that we think about, are told we're to think about, or we struggle with because we have an experience of working in an environment where we're not necessarily the majority. Like, I don't think people that are part of the majority group actually think about this in the same way. And I think we are trying to work in a workplace, workspace that perhaps wasn't built for us and by us. And the rules were not created with us in mind. And therefore, it's something that we are kind of told we have to think about, we struggle with, because ultimately the original framework didn't fit us.
As in women working, is that?
As in women, yeah. As in women working, because I feel like these conversations, and you know, very early on in my career, even maybe in, gosh, growing up in my small town, there was this feeling of like you can't have it all, you can't do it all, and you know, in sort of who these professions were built for, and who thrives and who doesn't, and. Yeah, I think it's something that we're sort of messaged that we have to think about it, we have to consider, we have to build our lives with that in mind, but I don't think we have to. It's almost similar to the whole imposter syndrome. Like, I think the way some of these phrases and these frames are brought to us that we have to consider, we have to think about, it's because these systems weren't built for us.
Hmm. That it's more a system issue. Yeah. And in the end, it's all life, right?
Yeah, work, exactly.
Home, everything, it's all life, yeah. Now, is there anything else you'd like to add that you think would benefit the listeners?
I'll bring it back to the book and just say that this is not a cover-to-cover read necessarily. It can be. And also, it is absolutely a manual. We made the table of contents detailed so that people can flip to something they want to work on. One of my best friends from college is in a leadership position in dermatology. and she had to have a difficult conversation. So she flipped to the pages on having a difficult conversation, or she needed to lead a meeting. And so she flipped to the area where we talk about running meetings. So we think that this is a tool that people can use and go back to on many occasions.
We hope people feel like even reading just one page of this book, that they have something that they have learned. I think that's very important to us. As we wrote the book, we really tried to find solutions that were immediately actionable, implementable. You'll see in the book, I don't think we ever suggest going to go get an MBA or going back to grad school, because we know that there's a lot of privilege in that solution. We know that that takes a lot of time and money, and not everyone can do that. So we really focused on solutions that we felt like truly, I mean, as the tagline of the book says, if you buy this book on Friday, better at your job on Monday. And I know it's kind of a funny phrase, but it's also something that we really centered the book on when we were writing the critical actions, is like, is this something that can actually be done now? Or does this person have to wait 5 years before they can actually start to do this because they need to, you know, change jobs, they need to wait until they're promoted 3 times or get another degree? Like, we really didn't want it to feel like there's delayed gratification. We wanted people to feel like, you know, by the end of this book or by the end of a chapter or by the end of a micro skill, they have learned something that they can start, you know, that same day.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. And how can people find it, reach out to you, get the book?
We're on all the socials. We have personal websites, AdaraLandryMD.com, RisaLewisMD.com. We're on LinkedIn, Instagram, X. The book is available wherever books can be pre-ordered. If you go to HarperCollins and type in microskills, you'll see the tabs, the boxes to pre-order. People have asked, is it going to be available as audio? And the answer is yes. Adair and I have spent time in the studio recording and reading the audiobook.
Oh, that's great. It's both your voices. I like that.
Most importantly, it's Risa's voice. Mine is there, but like most importantly, we have Risa holding it's down the fort.
So, well, it's such a great voice to listen to, I have to say. So.
It is a really nice voice.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for coming on. It's so great we could get a time from the East Coast of Australia and the East Coast of the USA. And it's been great to chat to both of you, Risa and Adara.
Thank you, Isabella.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Balance Medics Handover Podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, I'd love for you to take a minute to rate and review this podcast and click the follow button. For more resources, check out the Balance Medics website. The link to this will be in the show notes below. See you next episode.